Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Chandran Kukuthas. Chandran is the Lee Kong Chian Professor of Political Science and the Dean of the School of Social Sciences at Singapore Management University. His research engages with central questions in social and political philosophy, including questions regarding toleration, multiculturalism, political authority, and social justice. His new book has just been published with Princeton University Press. It's titled Immigration and Freedom. Now, discussions of the ethics and the politics of immigration tend to focus on those seeking entry into a new society. We ask whether a country has the right to exclude those who would like to relocate within it. We explore the moral implications of more or less restrictive policies concerning immigration, often with a view towards the plight of the immigrants or refugees and the perils of their statelessness. These are, of course, important questions. But Kukuthas asks us also to examine the ways in which a state's immigration policies are exertions of control over its domestic population. It's often overlooked that a state's exercise of its supposed right to exclude always involves the exercise of power over its own citizens. So we should ask, are these exercises justifiable? Moreover, the entire issue is inevitably couched in concepts like citizen, native, domestic, foreign, immigrant, border, and sovereignty. But these concepts are notoriously slippery. So as usual, we have a lot to talk about, a full slate, as it were. But why don't we begin, as we normally do, with our guest. Hello, Chandran. How are you?
Hi, Bob. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. So the book is really fantastic, but before we get to talking about immigration and freedom, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm an immigrant, quite obviously in a way, because I'm here in Singapore. I was born in Malaysia, ended up in Australia where I became a citizen after 15 years or so, and have been a citizen of Australia for, I guess, about 40 years, but since my time in Australia, I've lived in the United States, in the UK. I was professor of political theory at the London School of Economics, and then I moved to Singapore about 2 years ago. So I guess that's a pretty important part of my my persona. I also grew up in a family of immigrants in a way, because my grandparents all were immigrants from Sri Lanka, from where Jaffna Tamils. So yeah, I guess immigration has been a big part of my life in a very practical sense.
Fabulous. And am I remembering correctly that when your time in the States, you were in the Midwest? Is that right?
I was in the West. I was professor of political theory at the University of Utah, and I've lived, actually all around the US over the years, because I've had various visiting fellowships to right. universities in Indiana, in Ohio, in Virginia. And then I spent a lot of time traveling around teaching and lecturing in different parts of the world, including Vanderbilt, right. as you will recall.
That's right. So great. Let's dig into the book, which I found a real eye opener in lots of respects. But I usually begin these interviews by asking a first question about the methodology or the big picture that got the author into the topic. I'm going to sort of switch gears a little bit here. I want to begin with the end of the book, if that's okay. So I found your epilogue, kind of moving. and so it was both a way I thought that it set up all of the philosophical issues in a really vivid way. But then it also, I thought, sort of encapsulated some of the conclusions that you draw. So, the epilogue is a short reflection, as it were, on it's asking us to imagine what it would be like if one needed a visa to fall in love. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's a poem that I wrote in a period just after I had applied for permanent residence in the UK. I had been there for 5 years as professor of political theory, and I'd been there on what was then called a work permit. That category no longer exists. But the UK had just brought in a requirement that anyone seeking permanent residence or citizenship take a life in the UK test. This was a series of questions that you had to answer. They supply you with a little booklet, and essentially you've got to memorize the answers to this. Now, the questions were, in a sense, a little bizarre, because although there were some obvious questions that might be asked about the United Kingdom to see whether you knew something about life there, what kind of political system it had, something a little bit about its history, perhaps. But this was full of questions about things like the sociology of the United Kingdom, questions like what proportion of the country is made up of this ethnic group, or questions like what time of year does the school year begin in Northern Ireland? What time does the school year begin in Scotland? There were all kinds of very, very bizarre questions that you had to answer in order to become eligible, if you passed the test, for permanent residence, or as it was called there, indefinite leave to remain in the UK. I was very struck by this. Shortly after I'd taken the test, a friend of mine who'd been in the UK for more than 10 years was applying for permanent residence herself, and she was stuck out in the United States, unable to return, and just waiting for authorization. And it just struck me at that time that this was really kind of bizarre, that she was stuck out there, and I'd just taken this test. So that's when I wrote the poem. And over the years that followed, I shared it with a few people who commented on it and said things like, well, you should really say something, for example, about the legal aspects of this. So I tinkered with it over a few years, and someone then said to me, actually a colleague in London said, you should really put this in your book. And I ummed and ahed about it for a while, because it's obviously not usual to begin or end a work of philosophy with a piece of poetry, especially one's own poetry. But I just thought, okay, I'll try it, and Princeton were fine. So that's how it ended up there. But it was a very heartfelt set of reflections on all the things that go on when you're subject to immigration control, and I tried to express this by you know, drawing attention to the incongruity of it all by imagining whether, you know, what it would be like if you needed to get a visa to do something that we all take for granted, which is, you know, to fall in love. Just as right. In a different world, we might have taken for granted the freedom to move to another place.
Right. Right. Well, it's evocative in all kinds of ways. So I'm really glad that you decided to share it. You know, there is there's a reality show in the States. I don't know if you are familiar with it, called 90 Day Fiancé.
I don't know that.
Oh, it's a reality show about couples. One person in the couple will be an American citizen, and they have fallen in love with somebody who is not an American citizen, usually on vacation or, you know, and the reality show is a reality show about them having 90 days where they can bring the spouse into the United States and decide whether to get married or not. And it's in lots of ways as ridiculous as it sounds. But, you know, since reading your book, you know, I've been sort of thinking about, you know, how, you know, this piece of pretty tawdry, I should mention, entertainment actually is philosophically very peculiar.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
that a state can come and say, you don't get to marry that person. Sorry, you couldn't make it happen in 90 days. So that person's going back to, you know, the Czech Republic. And that's, you know, that's the
end. Yes, well, this is all too common an occurrence. I think I mentioned in my book that each year about 18,000 people in the UK are denied the freedom to unite or reunite with their spouse, largely on the grounds that they don't have sufficient funds or income to sponsor someone. So this is a rule that, you know, creates a burden that falls disproportionately on people who are poor. You need to have an income of about £18,000 a year, which you might think is not a lot, but actually most people don't make that much, which is also
right.
Something that's quite eye-opening.
Sure. So great. Let's now go back to sort of, you know, take the book up at the beginning. A central theme that runs throughout the book, and one of the concepts and ideas that gets introduced very early, is the idea that immigration policies are exercises of control. And for that reason, they limit freedom. But you're keen, and I think you're rightfully keen, to point out that these policies limit freedom not only of those seeking entry into a new nation or a new state or a new territory, but the policies also limit the freedom of those who are considered already to be members of the domestic population. So a large part of the argument of the book proceeds by way of a critical analysis of some of the conceptual materials with which this big thought about immigration, that there is a right to exclude or a right to control who's in and who's out. So the argument is really these conceptual materials are not as sturdy as the way we deploy them might suggest. So why don't we begin there with the idea of things like the idea of an immigrant or the concept of a border. Early in the book, you list, you know, it's got to be more than 10 attempts to define what an immigrant is. So can you tell us a little bit about how things get complicated, even at this sort of abstract conceptual level so quickly?
Yes. Well, the first, in a way, most obvious thing is that the definition of immigrant is a tricky matter, because an immigrant is not someone with a particular set of characteristics that one might identify. Being an immigrant is being someone who falls into a particular legal category. And in different countries, the legal categories are identified differently. In fact, most countries don't have a definition of immigrant. In the UK, for example, in the law, there's only the category of persons with the right to remain or the right of abode in the United Kingdom. So an immigrant is something, or is a term that's often invoked, but there's no clear way of determining whether someone is an immigrant or not an immigrant. For example, the United Nations defines an immigrant as someone outside his or her country of nationality for 12 months or longer. But you can immediately ask, well, why 12 months? And there's nothing special about 12 months. It's just an arbitrary stopping point. If you made it 6 months, then we'd have a lot more immigrants in the world. And if you made it 6 days, most tourists would be immigrants in one sense or another. But if you made it 5 years, then there'd be many fewer people who'd be categorized as immigrants. I think most people think of an immigrant as someone who's actually moving to settle in a country. But when it comes to immigration control, it's something that affects people who move, more generally. And so the law tries to categorize people in order to establish their rights of movement. But in a way, the reason why there is this sort of control is that there's a concern to protect the interests of natives or nationals over the interests of immigrants. This is how the defense of such measures is usually couched. But here, the other side of the definitional problem is the notion of a native or a national, because just as the definition of an immigrant is simply an arbitrary matter, so is the definition of a native or a national, because this also turns out to be a legal category, and states at various times have decided that some people are or are not nationals. Let me give you an example of this. This is a slightly dramatic one in a way, but I think you'll see that it actually has equivalence in other parts. And this is the case of the British Empire. Mm-hmm. Now, by the end of the Second World War, Britain had an empire that encompassed more than 800 million people all around the world, people who were obliged to pay taxes, who were subject to military service in some cases, who were in various ways simply ruled by Britain. But at this time, they were also regarded by Britain as British subjects. They had, in principle, the right to travel anywhere within the empire, although some countries within the empire, like Australia and South Africa, managed their own internal immigration policy, so excluded people from the empire from traveling there. But all these people were British subjects. They were British nationals. To put it very simply, they were in fact British. Even a politician like Enoch Powell, who was notorious in the 1960s for his wish to limit immigration to the United Kingdom, said that right now it was not actually possible legally because all of these peoples were British subjects and had the legal right to move to Britain and had all of the rights that anyone in Britain had. As it happened, over the next 15 to 30 years, the rights of all these British nationals outside of the British Isles had their nationality progressively stripped away from them. The beginning of this really was the move in 1971 to redefine nationality to exclude Africans, or more specifically, Africans of Indian descent who were under threat of deportation in places like Kenya and Uganda. And the British authorities didn't want this to happen, didn't want them to be likely to move to the UK. So they essentially stripped people of this nationality. And this brings me to my more general point, really, that the beginning of immigration control is, in fact, classification. You classify people as immigrants or nationals. And over the years, nations have had different sorts of definitions of immigrants and different sorts of rules for how to count people as natives or nationals. to give you a different set of examples. In the United States, as many of your listeners would know, for a long time, people of African descent could not be American citizens because there was a color test. If you were not white, you could not be an immigrant. This led to, especially in the 20th century, many disputes about what counted or who counted as white. The Supreme Court at various stages ruled, for example, that people from one part of India would not count as white, Punjabis, for example, but people from other parts, maybe because of their appearance, would count as white. Syrians would count as white after an appeal was made by a man called George Dow. At this time, in the early 20th century, a woman, native-born, though she might have been to the white American parents, if she married a foreigner, would lose her nationality. She would be stripped of her American citizenship because the definition of nationality required a certain kind of story about your origins and your background. So the definition of an immigrant is just the other side of the definition of a native or of a national, and there's nothing natural about this. So if we think that the point of immigration control is to protect the interests of natives against the interests of immigrants, it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of this happens as a result of attempts to define people in a particular way, to define them as immigrants. And this obviously leads to another very important thought, which is that immigration control really is a way of controlling people. And the outcome is dependent in a way on who has the power, whether individually or collectively, to determine the nature or the definition and then the fates of their fellow citizens.
Right. So can I just ask a quick question, which is sort of about international issues? So if not only are these concepts sort of slippery and, they're not tracking natural kinds, they're not cutting nature at its joints, as it were. But if there's also sort of some disarray between different states in how to categorize people, this is an empirical question. How easy is it to just be stateless because, you meet somebody's character, you meet some state's definition of what it is to be an immigrant, and you don't meet the other state's definition of what it is to be a native?
Well, this obviously does happen around the world to varying degrees. There are people who are literally stateless, and this is obviously a very terrible position to be in because it means you're essentially deprived of all kinds of rights. In Hannah Arendt's terms, you don't have the right to have rights. And, in a different era, that mightn't have been so difficult because not having, a state you can call yourself a member of did not necessarily preclude you from moving, from traveling, from settling, and so on. But in the era of immigration control, which really is something that has emerged with the development of the nation state and become strengthened as the state has become more important, it's become less and less easy or even possible to do anything without state membership. You can't move anywhere without papers or a passport. Fortunately, there's a small number of people who are caught in this situation. But, for those people, that's not a trivial matter.
Right. So the next step of the argument then looks at the idea of control and border control and controlling or securing the borders. The idea or the sort of thrust of the argument is that although it's common, especially these days in the States to hear people talk about immigration policies as a way of securing, protecting regions of physical space, right? Part of your argument is that these are actually ways of controlling people. They're not ways of, you know, they're not at least in the first instance sort of so focused on physical locations, because borders shift and change and are blurry and the rest. As you aptly put it, you say it's difficult to control some people without controlling others. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, it really struck me when I was teaching at the LSE, and as immigration controls became stricter, as government started to target various sorts of categories of people who might, they feared, be violating immigration regulations, they started to make impositions upon us as academics to make sure that the students that we'd had, particularly overseas students, were in fact properly monitored, so that they weren't in some way in violation of their visa. Consequently, we were under pressure to do things like take attendance, have students and overseas faculty report to the department. And we had to report this to the Home Office to indicate that we were, in fact, ourselves being vigilant about immigration control. So this was, costly both in resources and in time. And of course, it also put us in a certain amount of jeopardy, because if we did not comply with this, then the LSE would be in danger of losing something like its education license or its freedom to admit other overseas students. And in some cases, universities were in fact shut down because they hadn't been closely monitoring their students. And what occurred to me then is that these controls actually were as much controls on us as they were on students. And in fact, they fell most heavily on people within the society rather than on those who were outside, because those who were refused permission to enter faced a one-off set of restrictions and then had to go about their business, about their lives just outside of the UK. But for us, this meant continual monitoring and surveillance to make sure that we were, in fact, compliant. And it then dawned upon me that actually most of immigration control is not border control. It's not about trying to stop people crossing the border, although that's a part of it. Most of it is actually about trying to make sure that people who did cross the border didn't do things that the authorities didn't want them to do. Mostly this was they didn't want them to enter the labor market. That is to say, they didn't want to take jobs. They also didn't want them to do things like enroll in a college or rent a home or open a bank account or stay longer than they wanted. And immigration controls were, for the most part, attempts to limit what these people did once they crossed the borders. Governments want people coming in as tourists and spending money, but they don't necessarily want them doing anything else without permission. And in order to control this, it becomes almost impossible unless you control your own citizens and right. residents, because if you don't, they're very likely to trade with outsiders, very likely to hire them or to enroll them in college or to rent them a property or to fall in love with them and marry them. So all of these things have to be controlled if you're going to control immigration. You can't do this without controlling your own citizens, because they're just all too likely to relate to people in very natural and human ways. If you want a sense of this, just think about how people feel now during the pandemic. the way in which we become so conscious of the importance of human contact, of close personal relationships, built on actual physical, propinquity. Mm-hmm. That also suggests that, it's going to be very, very unlikely that anyone coming into a country is going to be just isolated. The natural right. thing for people to do is, in fact, to relate to, befriend, associate in all kinds of ways, some of them not really legal or appropriate, but still in all kinds of ways with outsiders. So much so that it actually becomes quite difficult to distinguish insiders from outsiders. So immigration control ultimately has to try to make these distinctions and has to try to monitor the behavior of people who are associating. And this will inevitably mean imposing all kinds of restrictions or requirements on your own citizens. And I think this is exactly what continues to happen.
Right. Yeah, and it does seem a little peculiar in a way that's just an extension of what you've just been saying, that the immigration policies were, in the example you were just talking about, were then, sort of the enforcement of the policies in part fell to the faculty, right? It's like, insofar as you're monitoring and reporting, that's just, you've kind of been enlisted as a kind of cop, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate this, but to varying degrees, that is in fact the case. And while it wasn't likely that I myself would be in trouble with the political authorities if I didn't take attendance, I could be in trouble with the university if I didn't do this, because the university would be in trouble with the authorities if it didn't do certain things. And with all these regulations, of course, they come and go, because they're not only difficult for the university to enforce, but it's also difficult for the authorities to enforce this on the university. Right. And and there's a political cost to this too. I mean, if they wanted to shut down the LSE, which is not something very likely, this would have all kinds of other effects as well. So it becomes a kind of game which has an unsavory aspect to it, because it's not all a game that's played in good faith by any of the parties, really.
Right. And one of the game pieces, the game pieces are at least in part like, people's lives.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Let's not forget. This might be a nice segue into, sort of the next stage of the argument. Because then you argue that sort of the more robust the immigration controls are in a particular state or society, the more the values of a free society are threatened or jeopardized. Particularly, you think that robust immigration controls are threats to the equality within the society. Can you tell us how that argument works?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm keen to point out is the extent to which the pursuit of particular policy goals or outcomes in a way ratchets up the expectations and the requirements. Because let's say you set a target of reducing the number of net immigrants to 100,000. I'm taking an example from the UK, when they found in a particular year the net migration had gone up to 300,000 people in the year. So the government promised that they would reduce this to 100,000. Now, this means that in order to achieve the target, they've got to require their officials, both at the higher level and at the street level, to find ways of achieving this goal. The problem is that you can't achieve this goal just by setting the target, because you've actually got to find ways then of limiting the number of people who are coming into the country or who are taking on a particular status. Now, the problem here is that if people really want to come in, or more, just as importantly, people within the country want others to join them, whether it's because they want them to be employed or whether they want them to, you know, join them as members of the family, they're going to find every way that they can to get what they want. University is going to, you know, look for every legal avenue it can to employ the people that they need, families who want to be reunited, or spouses or lovers who want their partners to come back, will look for ways. And so what political authorities will need to do is just find some ways of excluding, if they're not making it, just by, you know, setting a target. You can do this, for example, by deporting people. But this is difficult because all too often it's hard to and expensive to actually engage in this. It's costly both in resources and time to bring people before the courts, to go through the process, to give them the right of response, and so on. But if the target is really important, then the temptation is going to be to find ways around this. So let me give you an example from the United States. Between 1930 and the start of this century, about 1 million American citizens were deported, obviously by mistake, but nonetheless, they were in fact deported. And a large part of the reason for this is at various stages, there was pressure to reduce the numbers of immigrants in the countries. And so the governments of various states, as well as the federal government, initiated sweeps of neighborhoods where they thought there might be illegal immigrants. And so, you know, in the course of this, 1 million people, mostly Mexicans over, you know, the 70 years, were simply, you know, deported to a country that they weren't citizens of, and in some cases, countries that they, you know, never visited, and there were people who were themselves American citizens of many generations. The reason for this is simply that, you know, often the authorities just assume that people living in a particular neighborhood who looked Mexican and who didn't have papers, and of course, if you're a citizen, why would you have anything to prove if you're just born there? So they would be deported. And that's a lot of people. I mean, if you think about that, and this is, you know, when 2 million people were deported overall, but 1 million of them were American citizens. And just by the way, this continues to happen even today. I mean, there are literally thousands of American citizens who are deported by their own government every year. And the same happens in the UK and in Australia and in other countries of Europe. And it happens because it's costly to get the categories and the identities right. And if you're under pressure to meet targets, then you're going to find ways around this. I mean, if you think about the United States, it supposedly has about 12 million so-called illegal immigrants. It has the capacity, using the courts, the detention facilities, the police, and so on, to deport about 400,000 people a year. So that will take you 25 years to deport everyone if no one came in illegally. In order to, you know, reach any kind of meaningful target, therefore, people are going to be tempted to go around the law. Now, to go back to the start of your question, you know, how does this bear on equality? Well, firstly, it means treating your citizens unequally, most obviously in the fact that people with a particular kind of appearance, or people without the appropriate papers, or without the financial resources to resist these injustices, they will be the ones who are disproportionately affected by this imperative to control immigration. So immigration control does fall disproportionately on a certain, you know, set of categories of citizens. So in this way, it's something that really damages equality, because firstly, it treats people differently, depending mostly on their appearance or their wealth. And secondly, you know, it violates what we would, you know, regard as the rule of law, because there's a temptation to get around the law in order to achieve, to achieve particular ends. So that's the first way in which immigration control really really shapes people's lives in a way that violates equality. The other respect in which it violates equality is that immigration control ultimately is control exercised by governments or authorities which don't want to simply exclude everyone, because all countries want immigrants for one reason or another. They want they want people entering the labor market. They want people coming in when it's of value. But once you do that and you realize that you still need people, you're going to then have to be selective. And immigration generally, and immigration control tends to be selective. And all too often it ends up being selective on the basis of a range of considerations. Sometimes it's, you know, it's skill, but also very often it turns out that what becomes important is, you know, your racial or your ethnic or your religious background. And to the extent that this is the case, immigration control ends up essentially saying to some of the citizens of the country, we're prepared to let people from these parts of the world, people who are like some of us, but not allow people who are from other parts of the world, people who are like more like some of you. This is essentially what immigration control has been like for the entire history of immigration control. So it really means saying to your citizens, some of you are going to be treated in one way and others of you are going to be treated differently. It's going to mean treating your citizens unequally. And that, I think, is something that's very serious from the point of view of countries like ours, liberal democracies that value equality along a number of different dimensions, from ethnicity to wealth and income. So I think it's very important to keep this in mind. Immigration control is not something that's just neutral. It never has been, and I think it really never can be.
Right. So very good. So now I suspect that some of our listeners will be familiar with a certain kind of ethical defense of immigration control. A kind of defense that's rooted in a claim about the cultural integrity of the society. The thought here is that immigration, when it reaches a certain or surpasses a certain threshold, can dissolve the shared culture of a society, its traditions, its language, so on and so forth. And the normative claim is that societies have a kind of right to preserve themselves. And this requires allows them or permits them to control or to keep out outsiders. So the cultural integrity kind of argument provides the basic justification for immigration controls. So you find this argument unpersuasive. Can you tell us why?
Yeah. Maybe the way to start this is to reflect for a bit on the very nature of the claim that's made, which is that we need to exclude people from our society because we want to protect our traditions or culture or way of life. And implicit in this claim is that there is, in fact, a coherent we or our, and that the people making these claims are authoritative spokesmen for this and have both the right and the understanding to say, you know, who we are, what our culture is, and who does or does not count as a suitable person to join this particular collective. But in reality, given that at you know, at any time in countries like the United States or Australia or the UK, there are people who, in fact, want outsiders to join them, just as are those who want to exclude them. So the debate about whether to include or exclude on cultural or on other grounds is actually a debate among people within the society who have different views. That is to say, some people want outsiders to come in and don't think that this is a threat to our culture or way of life, and those who think that the outsiders shouldn't come in. So it's a conflict within the society. Now, what this illustrates immediately is that people within the society don't agree on a number of fundamental things. Firstly, they don't agree on whether or not people should be, or particular people should be allowed in or should be excluded. But they also don't, in fact, agree on the fundamental question of, well, what is this society, this culture, this shared way of life? Because for some of them, it would be, you know, possibly even enhanced if we brought other people in. Whereas for some people, people coming in is a danger to something. So anyone making the claim that we need to do this for the purpose of cultural integrity or cultural protection is making a claim that is disagreed with by a significant proportion of the citizenry. But the other thing to bear in mind then is that it does require those making this argument to say something about what that culture in question is. Now, there are two kinds of ways you might approach this. One would be to say, well, you know, the culture in question is a very specific understanding of how one should live. It may involve, you know, shared religious commitments. It may involve shared beliefs on a whole range of other ethical and normative matters and so on. But this is not going to work if the society is itself quite diverse, particularly the case in, let's say, the United Kingdom, where there are different religious traditions, different denominations of Christianity, but also other religions are prominent there, Muslims, Hindus, people of the Jewish faith, and so on. So you'd have to say something to the effect that there is a culture, despite the fact that there is so much diversity within it. So it simply flies in the face of reality to say we have, in fact, a thick and shared set of cultural commitments. On the other hand, you could say, no, we're not saying something as strong as that. What we're saying is that what we have is a society that's still, you know, culturally diverse, but which shares a kind of way of life that includes all these other traditions and ethnicities and religions and so on. But if you do that, then it's very difficult to see how excluding people is going to be in any way necessary if outsiders themselves will simply be joining people who are themselves already diverse. So you're not going to change the character of the country. If you wanted to say it's going to change the balance, well, it's hard to know what exactly is the end game here, because so many things could change the balance, including, you know, different rates of birth, people's tendency to want to themselves migrate to other parts of the world, people's inclination to welcome outsiders or intermarry. So if you really want to try to control the cultural composition and keep it exactly as it is now, there are all sorts of policies that you might want to engage in, which I think most citizens would find troubling. So I think neither of these arguments really is sustainable. And attempting to control the cultural shape of a society is a very, very tricky matter. And of course, there is just the fact that over the decades and the centuries, societies change to varying degrees, not just because of migration, but because of interaction in all kinds of other ways. I think one should pause to consider the whole idea that you're going to try to control the cultural composition of a society. That is a very substantial undertaking, and it's not clear that anybody is going to succeed in this. The most you can do is you can have some kind of short-term effect, but in the long term, you're always going to be at the mercy of the preferences that people actually have. So I think the cultural arguments in the end for me don't really stack up, because firstly, you can't actually achieve the goals in question. But secondly, you can't even attempt to reach those goals without infringing enormously on the freedoms of your own citizens by preferring some of your citizens to others, without in fact trying to say something which your citizens may resist, which is to say what it is to be an Englishman or a Brit or an Australian or a Frenchman or an American. Right. People have very, very different views about what this is, what these categories are, what these things mean. And to try to settle the issue, I think, is a very dangerous thing to do.
Right. Fabulous. So, you know, there are other issues that are taken up in the book that we're not going to have time to talk about, including a really nice chapter on the economics of immigration or economic arguments about immigration, and also a chapter about self-determination of states. I wanted to make sure, though, since you've been so generous with your time, I want to make sure that I get to the way you formulate the sort of the big question that ends the book in the final chapter, where you say something like, look, so, you know, if the arguments go through of the book, have shown that immigration controls constrain freedom for everybody, not just for would-be immigrants, but for the home population. And you say, so it's still a question, though, why this should matter. You know, maybe on balance, it's a kind of infringement of freedom that's worth it or that's justified, and that we shouldn't, in the end, maybe be so concerned about the ways in which immigration policies control us. So what's the answer? Why does this matter? Or why should it matter to us that we're controlled by our country's immigration policy?
Yeah, I think this is a question that is surprisingly, I think, under-discussed, not just with respect to immigration or immigration control, but with respect to the question of freedom more generally. Why should we care about whether we're free? Why should we care about whether we're controlled? And in this book, what I do try to do is to suggest that one way to think about freedom is by thinking of it as not being controlled. But then the obvious question is, as you've noted, what's wrong with being controlled? And indeed, one of the arguments the objections I persistently meet with is an argument which says, look, we're controlled in so many ways. We're used to being regulated and to being monitored. We're used to standing in queue. We're used to having to apply for permission in all kinds of respects. This is just another way. Why care about this? And ultimately, this means, you know, asking, why would one care about freedom? And I think this is, in some ways, not an easy question to answer, because not everybody actually cares about freedom, and certainly not everyone cares about it in the same way or to the same degree. Many people are willing to forsake some of their freedom, or maybe even a lot of it, for other ends. If you think about people who join the military, they subject themselves to control by others. If you go into the priesthood, maybe become a monk, or if you join certain corporations, you become limited in various ways. So, you know, people don't all value freedom completely and to the exclusion of all other values. But what I want to try to say here is that, firstly, very few people don't value it at all. And for many people, it is, in fact, something that's very, very valuable. And I want to say that it's something that we should cherish maybe more than we're inclined to, whether it's in theory or sometimes in our conduct. So the question is, why should we care about it? Now, what I want to say in the book is that ultimately, why we should care about freedom is because it has a bearing on the kind of people we are or will become. Because if we don't care about this, then we have to accept a whole range of implications about how we live and how we see ourselves. So if we're ready to accept a regime of control, we're going to have to become people who, in a sense, become a different kind of person, people who are more ready to be obedient, to become compliant, to become accepting of limitations on what we do. We're going to have to become people who are ready to give up our independence, our autonomy, our capacity to just think for ourselves. And we have to become people who are more likely to simply accept things on faith, to accept things uncritically. There's a further aspect to this, I think, which is also, I think, very important, and this is critical for the argument I want to make in my book. We have to become people who are ready to accept the control that is exercised over others and become indifferent to it. We have to become people who are willing to say about maybe even the most, you know, egregious abuses of other people, that that's okay. And I think this kind of transformation of our consciousness is a very important implication of our readiness to accept control over ourselves. We then become ready to accept the various ways in which others are controlled. And if I can give you a more dramatic kind of example of this, in many societies we see immigrants and notably refugees who are treated very, very poorly, not just because they're excluded, but because they are detained, they are put into camps, they're subject to all kinds of treatment, which we would ordinarily say amounts to a violation of human rights, because it involves, you know, causing them to suffer in ways that we would consider intolerable if we were, in fact, ourselves subject to this, subject to both psychological distress and also physical distress. But over the years, you know, what governments have tried to do with respect to these sorts of cases is to assure the public that this is okay. You know, either these people are criminals, or these people have just jumped the queue, or, this is something you don't need to worry about because it's all taken care of. And as time goes on, we tend to become just used to this. We tend to say, well, okay, that's fine. If, you know, we're ready to accept this kind of injustice because we ourselves have become, in a way, indifferent to freedom. When you become indifferent to your own freedom, it becomes very difficult to then really care about the freedom of others. And what this means ultimately is we become a kind of society where all of these things become acceptable. And this can only be the case if we are people of a certain kind. I don't want to go too far and say we'll just become like sheep, but you know that, in a way, gets at the question that you're asking. We become compliant. We become less independent. We become people who are just willing to be, willing to accept what we're told, and we won't recognize it. Ultimately, what it'll mean is that we will become so indifferent that we won't recognize that our freedom has been lost. Again, I don't want to over-exaggerate this, because it's not that we're there now. But I do fear that for some people, this is exactly what's happened. They've just become indifferent. So the answer to the question, you know, why should we care about this? Why should we worry? The answer is, you will become a certain kind of person, and we will become a certain kind of society. And I want to say, is this really what you want? Is this really the kind of people that you or we want to be?
Well, that is, I find, a deeply compelling answer, especially given what seemed to be fairly, I don't know if it's right to call them popular, but fairly common attitudes in the States about the ways in which over the past couple years now, immigrants who've been detained and I think the right word is captured, have been treated, which it seems as if there's a huge contingent of American citizen that's okay with that kind of treatment of another human being, even in the case of children who can't, by on anybody's account, be, you know, sort of seen as the agent of that brought about their circumstance. So that's at least in my book, a very compelling argument. But Chandran, you've been, you know, really, really generous. I really want to thank you for joining me on New Books in Philosophy. It's been a real pleasure to talk about your book, which is titled Immigration and Freedom. Thank you, Chandran, for joining me.
Thank you very much, Bob. It was a pleasure.
The pleasure was mine. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for our discussion. My guest has been Chandran Kukathas. His new book is published with Princeton University Press, and I encourage you to go check it out. Once more, the title is Immigration and Freedom. Thank you for listening to New Books in Philosophy, and bye for now.